This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the great things about the HBO series The Wire is the cast, which includes many terrific actors who were not well known before. A good example is our guest, Michael K. Williams. He plays one of the most charismatic characters on the show, Omar. The Wire follows the intertwining stories of Baltimore politicians, cops, drug dealers, and the teenagers who sell the drugs on the corners. Williams' character, Omar, is a unique figure. His thing is robbing drug dealers who are in no position to complain to the police. Omar often walks through the streets in a long coat carrying a shotgun. He has a huge scar running down his face. He's feared because he's fearless. What he's not respected for in the hood is being gay. In fact, in a previous season, his lover was murdered, which led to a cycle of retribution. Here's a scene that was a turning point last season. Its consequences are getting played out this season. Marlo, the most powerful drug dealer in West Baltimore, is running a card game and winning when Omar crashes through the door with a gun in each hand.
All right, bud, let me see them hands, yo. Hands! Hey, yo, big man, back up.
I don't know about cars, but I think these 4-5s be the full house.
Hey, yo, banker, cash me out, yo. Boy, you want to hit on that body, you best hop, too.
That's my money.
Man, money ain't got no owners. Only spenders. I tell you something else. I like that ring, too. Boy, you got me confused when a man repeats himself.
This ain't over.
Well, that's how you carrying the shorty.
Huh? Because I can find your peoples a whole lot easier than they can find me.
Wear it in health.
No doubt.
Michael Williams, welcome to Fresh Air. People in the neighborhood are really afraid of Omar because they know what you do. And when the neighborhood kids see Omar coming, they run away screaming, "Omar coming!" How does it feel to have that reaction to you, even if it's only in fiction?
Well, the first time I couldn't get through without laughing. I couldn't fathom anybody would, you know, run away from me in total fear. You know, anybody that really knows me growing up, you know, in Brooklyn knows, you know, that's very far from my character. So I just had a hard time finding a believable state of mind to execute the character. I just kept going to laughter. But, you know, I like to think that people are not scared of him is why they do that. I think it's more of a respect thing. Like, they know that when this dude surfaces, you know, there's going to be gunfire. And I don't think it's necessarily like, oh, my God, Omar's going to kill me. It's like, okay, it's high noon. Let's get, you know, it's a showdown about to happen. Let's get out the way because, you know, stray bullets are, you know, can come this way. So I don't really think, not that they're running from him, that they're scared of what he represents when he comes.
Right.
And they want to get out the way of that.
So you said that anyone who knew you growing up would know that you weren't the kind of person who inspired fear. So how did you find that place in yourself so that you could portray that kind of power?
I play Omar from a very painful place. You know, it's a very dark state of mind to be in, a very painful state of mind. And I identify a lot with him on that level, you know, having overcome a lot of pain in life and stuff. So, you know, Omar, in my book, in my eyes, I don't play Omar as an alpha male. He's not one that would beat on his chest. And he's a very, very sensitive dude. He comes from a very humble place. You know, growing up in the hood, we always knew what the quiet one, the one that would kind of go inside. That's the one you watch out for, you know. So I play him from that aspect.
What's one of the most fearless things that you had to portray Omar doing up until this point in the series? Don't tell us about anything that hasn't happened yet.
I would say the most fearless thing that I was able to pull off and portray as Omar on television was his openness with his sexuality and not have that go over the top. It meant a lot to me that this character be taken seriously by my peers and by my community, and I didn't want this topic of his sexual orientation to hinder his his seriousness, and I didn't want to disrespect anybody in the gay community either. So it was like I was, I think in a strange way, it was okay when it's Omar, you feel me? It's kind of like, it was interesting to see that happen. I think that was one of the most challenging parts of his character.
We were implying that there's a lot of homophobic feelings in your community, but were you feeling homophobic about Omar too? Were you comfortable with him being gay?
I mean, it's all you look at is perception is everything with me. So I looked at it as an opportunity to stand out, to shine, to be that sore thumb, if you will. It was like, you know, I wasn't as much concerned about, you know, my homophobia toward this character as I was concerned about the fact that there are some stellar kick-ass actors on this roster, and I need to I got to make sure I meet the standard, you know. So I was more concerned about that, and I saw the whole, you know, I used, you know, the fact that this character had layers, none like the other characters. I looked at it as a silver lining in the cloud.
Now, Ed Burns, one of the main writers on the show, told me that Omar's first on-screen kiss wasn't in the script and that you actually improvised it. Would you describe the scene and tell us why you decided to add that kiss?
At that point in the script, I already knew from the breakdown that Omar was gay. And up until that point, it was a lot of new faces. The show was brand new directors, new actors, you know, and nobody knew who was what.
Yeah, the characters, you know, so many characters, it's hard to follow.
It was hard, even for us working amongst each other, it was hard to follow. So, you know, I would find that the writers were trying to find the characters in their minds and then also find the pushing point with the actors. Like, you know, how far can we stretch these guys? You know, just, you know, it was a trial and error process. And so, you know, by this time in the taping, you know, Omar, he would only rub his Brandon's hair, or he would, you know, caress Brandon's cheek or rub Brandon's back. And I'm like, if this is going to pop it, you know, let's get this out the way so we could establish this and move on from it. I want to, you know, it's like kind of like you know, you're going to get a whooping, like, let's hurry up and get it over with. You know, let's just hurry up and get this thing done so I can stop waiting for it to come. You know, let's just make it happen. So this particular scene was when it was in season one, and Omar and Brandon and Bailey, they were waiting for Bailey to come back so they can go, you know, hunting, basically. And he never shows up, and he's late, and Omar's a stickler for time. So they, you know, and if you remember, Omar doesn't curse. Brandon was, you know, used a lot of profanity to express himself, and Omar told, you know, expressed to him, you know, how ignorant that looks and how much he didn't, you know, like those words coming from such, you know, a beautiful mouth. And it was just, you know, ironic. They're waiting for their other buddy to go robbing, and they're having this like lover's conversation over, you know, all these guns and whatnot. So I was just like, I think this would be the good time to just, you know, throw that in there, you know. And so I go to the other actor, you know, Michael Darnell, and I say, Mike, let's put the kiss in this scene. He goes, you know, what? I'm like, I think it needs to happen now. You know, let's just get it out there. I go to tell him, and he goes like, you know what, Mike, just don't even tell me. It surprised me because I just want it to flow. So, yeah, and it just, that scene that you saw was pretty much just, we just kind of got into these characters, man, and got into their minds and went with it. And, it, you know, to me, to you know, to have these two dudes kiss and then for him to pick up his shotgun and put his bullets in and clink, clink, let's go hunting, it just was the ultimate contrast to me. And that's where I decided to put it.
What was the reaction on the set when you added the unscripted kiss?
You know, I'll tell you, ironically, guess who directed that episode?
Was it Clark Johnson?
Yeah, none other than Clark. You know what I mean? So, you know, he in the beginning of the rehearsal, he was setting the shot up. So, you know, he was like, okay, guys, rehearse. And, you know, he was like, okay, talking to the lighting men and, you know, looking at us. And, okay, now put the flap this way, you know, getting this shot together. And when it got quiet and they heard the smacking of the lips, Clark turned around, looked, he said, wait, hold on, cut. Hey, somebody get me some size. Give me some size. I don't remember seeing that in this. They had a little quick me. He said, excuse me, Mom. Omar. This guy, David Omar. Omar. I said, so, nah, I thought it would be a good idea to improvise that right here. You feel me? Just, you know, get it done. So from that day on, I noticed, you know, the light was a little bit more clear on me, you know what I mean? They started calling me, you know, get Michael K to the set, you know what I mean? You know, so definitely was a growth process.
You know, it's funny, like, the trait that is really most likable about Omar is the same trait that gets people to be uncomfortable with him, and that is that he is... He really loves the men that he's been with during the course of the series, and he's very loyal to them. And it shows that he really has a heart, unlike some of the characters in the series. Like Marlo, the drug dealer, he doesn't seem to have a heart. But that love, that homosexuality, is exactly what makes some of the fans of the show uncomfortable. So I'm wondering about what the range of reaction is that you get to the character.
It's just one range. It's you know, nothing but love. It's been crazy. I mean, men, women, children, anybody that watched that show, I've pretty much have gotten nothing but, you know, admiration for him, you know. I've got, you know, once in a while, I don't mess with what he do. I don't like that gay shit now. You know, I don't know about all that, but that's my dude outside of that. You know, I've got, you know, just, but, you know, the love just outweighs any negative, you know, energy that might be, or any type of, you know, lack of understanding, you know, that they may have for who this dude is. What they do understand about him, they love that part of him, and they just lock on to that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just that honesty. You know, this dude is just so real. He's so, like, just, and he's a stand-up dude, you know, and that's what, you know, end of the day, we kind of respect. He's old school. He runs, he lives his game, runs his game, and lives his life by the code of the streets, the old way, you know. And you know, in this season, you're gonna really see him fight to keep those rules alive, you know. But the rules change, but the game remains the same, and you know, that's just the unfortunate truth.
One of my favorite Omar scenes is, like, as I remember, he doesn't have, like, the breakfast cereal that he wants. So he goes out wearing only his robe. I don't think you were even wearing slippers or shoes. Goes to the neighborhood store to get it and kind of, you know, brings it back. But it's such a sign of power that he could just, like, do that in these, like, really mean streets. He's just going to walk out in his robe and go to the store.
You know, I think, like I said, you know, earlier, where that comes from, you know, because that could easily be perceived as ignorant as for a person who lives, you know, on the edge the way Omar does. But like I said earlier, you know, Omar doesn't operate from a, you better fear me, you know, and I'm the baddest big bad wolf and I'll kill everybody. That's not his mindset, you know. He's the opposite, actually, you know. But he's vulnerable, and that's what makes him volatile, you know. So he walks out there because he knows that, okay, I'm off right now, you know what I mean? I don't just run around and just kill people at random. I'm calculated. There's a reason behind my methods, you know. It's always a method to the madness, you know. So it's you know, he's out going for cereal. There's no need to carry my gun right now, really, you know. It's just, you know, in his mind, he thinks people are running because they think that he's working. He's like, don't y'all fools know I'm off right now? You know what I mean? You know, because everybody knows he would not run in that corner store that he was going to rob nobody. That's, you know, that's just, they know Omar doesn't do that. So they know that, you know, he ain't coming to rob them. He just, like I said before, they running just to get out of respect, right, for it's high noon, time to get out the way. Omar's here, some bullets going to fly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Williams, and he plays Omar, the guy who holds up drug dealers and steals their money in The Wire, which is currently on its fifth and final season.
Yeah.
Tell us how you got the part of Omar.
Nothing extraordinary. I got the call. I was always considered for Omar from day one.
Well, how? Did your agent send them a picture? Like, why were you being
what
considered?
What agent?
Okay.
I was working in my mom's daycare back in Flatbush. But, Yeah, so I get a call from Alexa Fogel. She faxed over the breakdown.
Who is she?
Besides,
Alexa
Fogel. Yes, Alexa Fogel's the casting director.
So how did she even know about you?
You know, I had before The Wire, did several Law and Orders. I did a film with Nicolas Cage, Martin Scorsese, Bringing Out the Dead. I had Sopranos under my belt. You know, I had a few spots that things I had done, but I took a break for like 2 years to work in my mom's daycare in the projects where she raised me at, and I did it for like about a year and 9 months, and decided I wanted to get back into business. And by November, I was putting my stuff back out there. I had a new reel I cut, put it back out there. And by March, I got the call for The Wire.
So, what was the audition like?
The audition was real. It was, like I said, Omar's a dark place, and I immediately, I identified with this dude for some weird reason. I knew exactly where his mindset was. I was probably not far from that state of mind at the time of the audition. And I just, the audition scene was, again, season one, where McNulty and Kima.
These are two of the cops.
Yeah, two of the cops, McNulty and Kima Greggs, they're following him, and he knows he's being followed. So he drives into the center of this cemetery, and they pull up behind him, and they have this conversation about, Barksdale, and what does their snitch Bubble know about Barksdale versus, that's how they find out the reason why I barely never made it to the house for them to go robbing when that kiss scene happened is because he got killed the night before. And so all that comes out in that one scene in the cemetery, and that was my audition scene. I put myself on tape once. Alexa Fogel sent it to the producers in Baltimore. Next thing I know, they were telling me to report the work.
Well, why don't we hear how that scene you're talking about actually turned out?
Omar with no gun on the street? Must be a first.
Yeah, sometimes who you are is enough, dog. But being as y'all sitting on my ride so long, I just thought I'd save y'all some time. Come straight on out. Now, I ain't taking no charge, and you only put me back up in no cage.
We're not here to bury you, Omar. We're pulling you up because we've got a problem in common.
Problem?
Barksdale.
Nah, he ain't no problem.
I don't know. Avon's been chalking up a lot of bodies, you being you.
Put it that way, I guess he could be a little problem, but I just can't really come out and help y'all. You know what I mean? Snitching just rubs me wrong. Personally, I don't think the game is played like that.
Well, we respect that. If you do happen to take a charge, though, I'm McNulty, that's Greggs. You give us a call, we'll sort something out.
Fair enough.
My guess is Michael Williams, and he plays Omar, who we just heard in that scene. Now, I heard that you were supposed to die after 7 episodes, but obviously you didn't. You're one of like the leading characters now in the final season. So were you told early on that you only had 7 episodes and then you were going to get killed?
Yeah, Omar was pretty much from the beginning a reoccurring character. That was the original idea for him. And I was grateful. I was grateful. I never had that word next to any character, any role I had up until then. So, I was like grateful for that, just that word. And so I was happy. I was happy to be there, man. And we did it. And, so around the 5th or 6th, maybe around the 3rd or 4th, I'm waiting to see this type of like, okay, they're not setting this up. I don't see where, I can see where this death is going to happen in the 7th episode. I'm like, it's looking like they're involving me more and more into the storyline. I'm like, this is going the other way, you feel me? So, I've been looking for the bullet since season 1.
It's hard to tell right now whether you're going to live or not. I'm waiting to see. I'm rooting for you.
Yeah.
So did they ever sit you down and say, okay, you're not getting killed off, or do you just like never know?
You never know. No mm-hmm. one never knows. They will. They will.
So
come
you're just
tell
living
you.
Episode to episode.
Everybody. That's everybody. Uh-huh. From the number one on the call sheet to the number 30s. I think we're 30 something deep in the cast crew, the cast list. But no one knows what's happening next. And it's so funny because you know we have a rumor mill on. Like I heard they writing stuff. You know, like, all kind of stuff, man. It's crazy. But we'd be like a bunch of kids with our ear to the end of a glass, with the glass pressed up against the door, against the writer's door, you know, trying to find out what they're going to do next. But it keeps us on our toes, keeps everything is kind of honest and humble.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael K. Williams, one of the stars of the HBO series The Wire. He plays Omar, who makes his money by robbing drug dealers. Before Williams got the part, he danced in music videos by such performers as Missy Elliott, George Michael, and Madonna. Williams discovered the actor who plays one of the strangest characters on The Wire, Snoop, a drug dealer's hitman. Here's Snoop at a chain hardware store buying a nail gun, which he will later use to nail shut the doors of vacant houses that have become tombs for her victims.
I see you got the DeWalt cordless. Your nail gun, DeWalt 410.
Yeah, the trouble is, you leave it in the trunk for a while, need to step up and use the bitch, the battery don't hold up, you know?
Yeah, cordless will do that. You might want to consider the powder-actuated tool. The Hilti DX460MX or the Simpson PTP, these two are my Cadillacs. Everything else on this board is second best, sorry to say. Are you contracting or just doing some work around the house?
No, we work all over.
Full time?
No, we had about 5 jobs last month.
At that rate, the cost of the powder-actuated guns justifies itself.
You say powder?
Powder.
Like gunpowder.
I asked Michael K. Williams about discovering Felicia Pearson. You're responsible for casting one of the strangest characters in The Wire, and that's Snoop, who's played by Felicia Pearson. And she's a hitman for the most powerful drug dealer in West Baltimore. And she speaks in this like mumbly slang that's really colorful, but it's also often incomprehensible. When she first appeared on the show, I really couldn't tell whether she was a male or female. Would you tell the story of how you met her?
Yeah. First of all, I have to correct you. That's how Baltimore speaks, or that part of Baltimore. That is the normal and accurate dialect and tone for the average Baltimorean who lives on the West Side or on the East Side in the hoods. You know, so it's that's not just her thing. We met in a club, a local bar in Baltimore, and she caught my eyes, like she caught America's eye. I was like, you know, trying to get a handle on what was her gender, you know, and her age. Because, you know, one eye said this is a 15-year-old little boy. And the other eye was like, but that could be just a really, you know, androgynous female. So she came over to me. We spoke. And she never watched the show, but she knew who I was. And just, you know, gave me props, you know, didn't ask me for nothing, didn't want to be on The Wire, didn't ask for no numbers for who, anybody, just really brief conversation. I just kept staring at her. And, you know, I mean, just like really rudely staring at her. And she just like, you know, I'm a female, right? 25 years old, just came home. And I, at one point she felt that she had to let me know that, you know, she had no interest in me whatsoever. So, you know, because I just kept staring at her. So, you know, when she confirmed that she was a female, that she was 25 years old, I was blown away. It was like a light bulb went off in my head. And I immediately just was like, you know, I just knew that I had to be a part of that, of her life, anything. I had no clue that, you know, the producers was gonna put her on the show. I wasn't even thinking that far, and man, they took it from there. That was pretty much my extent with it.
So they just wrote the part of Snoop for her when they saw her.
Just like that, mm-hmm. They spoke with her for 2 hours, man. Listened to her story, and next thing you know, she was Snoop on The Wire. She ain't looked back since, you know. I'm really proud of her.
You have a beautiful face, but you also have a scar running down most of the length of your face. How did you get the scar?
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. and fighting, barroom brawl, you know, typical New York City story, wrong place, wrong time, one drink too many. And
What was it about?
I was in a bar, and a friend of mine from Brooklyn was surrounded by a group of guys. Seemed they wanted to jump him, and I kind of stuck my nose in it. You know, Brooklyn's in the house. You're not gonna get jumped while me and my people's out here. So, you know, he ended up getting home, going home safe. Nothing happened to him, but I guess the crew of gentlemen didn't take too kindly to me. You know, I guess sticking my nose in their business. So, kind of diverted the energy towards me, and you know, some words were exchanged, and tempers got hot, and yeah, some razor blades came out of some mouths. The rest is history.
So, like, what happened next? Did you get an ambulance, or did?
Yeah, no, nah, we took ourselves to the hospital, and I.
You took yourself to the hospital?
Yeah, because it was me and two of my friends. We got jumped, and all of us got pretty much cut up, and someone told me to tell the police report that it was a attempted robbery. I don't know why I did that, but I just did, and it worked out in my favor because I ended up being eligible for the Crime Victims Bureau, which paid for my plastic surgery, which is the reason why the scar didn't keel on my face.
So initially, how did it change your life? Your life had to change by something as major as that.
Yeah, it definitely was a wake-up call. I almost died that night, though. The scar that most people see is not the one that endangered my life. There's one that goes from my earlobe to my jugular, and that's the one that scared me. I was like, you know, a lot of things were happening. I was, I had two Grand Theft Auto charges, cases that were open, was going to court for, and then this pops up. You know, I was being given an opportunity. You know, I was dancing, I was, you know, modeling and working, getting my little gigs and stuff, and I was happy in the direction that, you know, the universe was taking me as far as, you know, the business was concerned. But I had these little, like, these little dark situations that would just come up and bite me in my behind. And I think that me getting jumped that night was definitely the pinnacle of that wake-up call. And I just, like, you know, I just didn't think I was going to be living very much longer. It was just too many things happening too fast at one time.
So you were already doing acting and modeling when you got caught?
I was dancing more so. I was background dancing a lot.
Like on videos?
Music videos, going on tours and stuff. And I did a spread for this company called Rock Embassy, and they made all the tour jackets for recording artists like, you know, Queen Latifah, Janet Jackson, Madonna. I had all those tour jackets, and there was a huge spread that me and a good friend of mine, Charles Malik Whitfield, he and I did this spread for this company, and it hit all the magazines, all the hip-hop magazines like Right On and Word Up, those magazines, those publications at the time. Mm-hmm. And they hit the newsstand November 19th, and I got cut November 22nd. You know,
wow.
So my friends had this little joke that they called me the male Marla Gibbs.
Well, did you think your career was over?
I never even locked into that. You know, I was pretty much, how am I going to hide this $150 down my face? You know, because I was, you know, club kid era. So I was like, you know, I always had the flat top and, you know, the loud, trendy shirts. And, you know what I mean? I was a dancer. So that was my MO. So when this happened, I was like, damn, I got to switch it up. So, Seal was really big at the time. And, you know, he had just had all the media for putting his tribal marks on his face, and I was like, that's a great, great angle. I'm going to rock with that. So I bald my head, cut off all my hair, and I was like, I'm the new Seal. And I never locked into it. I never, like, you know, I was, you know, through the Crime Victims Bureau, I was supposed to go and get all this, like, psychiatric evaluation and yada, yada, yada. I thought it would be best if I not locked into any of that. You know, like when a baby falls, if they look at your face for your reaction to know how they should react. So I kind of just like use that psychology on myself and just like I just didn't trip.
So how did it affect future roles that you got?
I got, like I said, I got cut in November. By March, I was getting stopped.
And what year was it?
This happened 93, somewhere around 1993.
Mm-hmm.
This happened.
Mm-hmm.
It impacted my career a lot. I got cut in November. By March, I was literally just getting stopped in the street by photographers. Some among who were David LaChapelle. You know, he was one of the first ones that told me I had a beautiful face. James mentioned the third. He's like, you know, Lower East Side, man, back in the 90s, it was a good time. It was just like we were all growing. You know what I mean? It was a good time to be in the city. And that got the whole thing rolling.
So how did you get into doing music videos? Like, what was your first break there? How did you start dancing in the first place?
I always loved dance. I always, you know, it's the life of the party growing up and stuff as far as the dance was concerned. But I got into a lot of trouble in my teenage years, you know, messing around the streets, you know, drugs and stuff like that. And I had to go, you know, clear my head for a couple of months upstate. And
you mean like rehab or something?
Yeah. So when I came back from that,
or prison?
I just, like,
I'm not sure what
it was mandatory. So
right. Okay.
We'll leave it at that. But,
sure.
Yeah. And I came back from that, and I was like, you know, I said, I'm gonna get my life together. And I was I went to school, went to BMCC, which is Borough Manhattan Community College. I was taking a business there and got a good job at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals. It was about to make me a temp situation. It was about to make me permanent. And man, here goes Janet Jackson dancing her big old butt across my screen talking about Rhythm Nation. I just lost my mind. I just quit school. I quit my job. And I was like, this is it. I'm going to become a Janet Jackson dancer. And I was really serious about that. And, you know, I got, you know, ended up homeless for about a year or so.
Homeless? How come?
My family is not really big on that entertainment stuff. You know, I was a big boy. I was like 23 by this time. And, yeah, I mean, it's just like my family was really fed up. They was like, as soon as he see like he's starting to get his life together, he goes left again, yet again. He makes another left turn. What do you mean you're going to quit school and your good job to become a dancer? Are you crazy? So just trying to escape hearing all the, you know, just the downplay on what I wanted to do, I just kind of stayed away. And, you know, kind of, you know, I had to sleep on a few couches, a few trains, you know what I mean? But it wasn't long, give it about a year, it wasn't long before I started making money as a dancer. And
how'd you do it? I mean, how did if you're sleeping on trains, how did you get to the point where you're getting cast
in
music videos?
I stayed in the mix. I backstage was my best friend. That was like my Bible, backstage newspaper. I stayed in areas like Broadway Dance Center. I was always up there bothering somebody or you know, stepping out studios. I packed my backpack with a bunch of PJ sandwiches, and you know what I mean? I would literally just pound that pavement up and down Broadway, running up in record companies, finding out who's the new artist in the car. You need new dancers, man. Going to the clubs. I stayed in the clubs. You know, I was hungry. And before long, I started getting gigs. My first gig was Kim Sims. She had this record called Too Blind to See It. She's from Chi-Town. Big ups to Chi-Town. And that was my first gig. And I ain't looked back yet.
Well, your mother must be proud of you. She didn't think it was a realistic ambition, and look what you've done.
Yeah, she's very proud of me, and I'm just proud of the fact that she even, you know, loves me and hasn't like kicked me out of her life, crap I put her through. But you know, I must say though, she does not watch The Wire. She's, you know, my mother's the relationship that she and I have has been tested many, many times, and The friendship that we have today and how we, you know, how we vibe is not because I'm in show business. Just, I think she's just happy to see me alive and happy doing something I like to do.
You know, when I interviewed Clark Johnson, who plays the character of Gus, the city editor on The Wire, and who directed the first two episodes and the final episode of the series, I said to him, what should I ask Michael Williams when I talk with him? And the one question he suggested to me is, ask him how he's going to shake off the character of Omar.
You know, big up to Clark Johnson, that man is a beautiful mind. That's a hellified question. You know, I don't know if that's going to ever happen. And what's even scary is I don't even know if I want to shake it. Mm-hmm. Omar, like I said, it's a dark state of mind. And sometimes I scare myself when I get comfortable there. And so I don't know if I'm still kind of like, it's weird. It's weird. It was a real experience. It was very cathartic having been given the opportunity to play Omar. I don't know that I really have embraced everything that's happened, you know, having played a character like this. I would have never have thunk that what we did as a family down there in Baltimore would have created this type of response and admiration that we've gotten. And I don't know if I ever really want to let that feeling go. I don't think I'll ever get it that intensely again in this business. So I don't know if I want to ever really let that go. I'm going to hold on to that for as long as I can, I think. But I know with that comes that dark side, you know. It's a sad place, but I like being there, oddly.
Well, I really like watching you in The Wire, so I'm hoping that Omar makes it through the end, the end of the final episode.
Man, it's Baltimore, baby. Everybody dies.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me here.
Michael K. Williams plays Omar on The Wire. Here's Omar in a High Noon kind of showdown with Brother Muzon, who Omar once wounded but decided to spare.
I see you favor a 45.
Tonight I do. I keeps one in the chamber in case you ponder it. And that showpiece you got there.
Walther PPK, 380, double action.
Hit them Walters like to jump some.
As will you, with one in your elbow.
That gun ain't got enough firepower to make my joint useless. It definitely won't stop me from emptying out half my mag.
You might not hit me.
This range? And this caliber? Even if I miss, I can't miss.
I admire a man with confidence.
I don't see no sweat in your brow neither, bro.
I suppose we could stand here all night.
Suppose we could. Or settle this once and forever.
It's not easy being the younger brother of a famous singer. Just ask Chris Jagger. But it can also help when you're both part of a community taking off, like the Chicago soul scene did in the 1960s. Today, Ed Ward takes a look at the intertwined fates of The Impressions, Jerry Butler, and his brother Billy.
I'm a telling you, oh, I'm a telling you, I'm a telling you, I'm a telling you, I go to work. I try real hard to do my job, but before the day is gone, I find out I've done something wrong. I'm a telling you, oh, I'm a telling you, I'm a telling you, oh, I'm a telling you, days are getting longer and my nights are getting shorter and my way gets darker and my work gets harder now when I get home.
In the beginning, there were The Impressions, five Chicago teenagers who thought they were pretty good. And they were. Their chief songwriter, Curtis Mayfield, also had a beautiful high tenor and played guitar in a hypnotic gospel-influenced style. Their lead singer, Jerry Butler, though, was their secret weapon. Like a few other singers around Chicago, most notably Sam Cooke, he was in the process of inventing soul.
Could ever be.
For Your Precious Love was a good-sized hit in 1958, but the follow-up, Come Back, My Love, wasn't. The record label dropped the Impressions, but kept Jerry Butler, who was kind enough to hire Curtis Mayfield as his guitarist and songwriting partner, which turned out to be a very good idea.
He don't love you like I love you. If he did, he wouldn't break your heart. He don't love you like I love you. He's trying to tear us apart.
That's Mayfield on harmony, too, on Butler's first solo single, which took him to the top of the charts. But Mayfield and the Impressions got signed by another label and started having hits of their own. And as the 1960s progressed, Butler leaned more towards big productions, which showcased his voice, and the Impressions towards stripped-down numbers where Mayfield could support the vocals with his guitar. And while Butler recorded what is probably the definitive version of Moon River, he was still hyper-aware of keeping things soulful.
I stand accused of loving you too much. I hope, I sure hope it's not a crime, 'cause I'm guilty.
But Butler was recording for VJ Records, and when they went under, he found a couple of young men in Philadelphia who wanted to make records with him. Under Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, Jerry Butler found songwriting partners and producers who'd make him bigger than ever.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy.
Oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, 'cause the woman that you love is gone. Oh, there's gonna be a whole lot of trouble in your life. Oh, so listen to me, get up off your knees, 'cause only the strong survive. That's what she said, only the strong survive. Only the strong survive. Yeah, you gotta be strong. You better hold on. Don't go.
Only the strong survive brought Butler's career to a new height in 1969, and the Iceman, as he was known from his cool onstage demeanor, would stay there for a few more years. But who knew that back in Chicago there was another Butler? Well, Curtis Mayfield, for one, and Carl Davis of OK Records, for whom Billy Butler, 6 years younger than brother Jerry, had run sessions, sung backup on them, and contributed songs. Finally, in 1963, Billy and his group, the Four Enchanters, got their break, but their records, although good, went nowhere. It wasn't until 1965 that they hit the charts with a Curtis Mayfield song.
See my woman right now, and we ain't getting any younger. I've got to get to her love somehow. When clouds come, it's raining, it's raining. The sun comes and shines. Lord, I ain't complaining, complaining. I've done wrong and I'm serving my time.
The song isn't the most original, and Teacher Wilshire's arrangement is too busy, but you can hear a good voice in there, and it charted. His next and last hit for OK was a lot better.
Girl, what's on your mind? What are you trying to tell me now? Are you feeling sad and blue? Because money's low and everything seems to go wrong. Well, my shoes got a hole. Trying to reach my goal too long to give up on my journey.
Right Track was the end of Billy's career with OK, although he continued to record into the 70s. Today, the Butler brothers are still in Chicago. Jerry is a singer and politician, and Billy, after many years of ill health, is reportedly considering a comeback.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.